This podcast is brought to you by MITEX, the Massachusetts Innovation and Technology Exchange, the region's premier association for thought leadership, technology trends, building business relationships, and professional training and development. For more information, go to www.mitx.org.
Dan Bricklin was an MBA student at Harvard Business School in the late 70s when he came up with the idea for VisiCalc, the first electronic spreadsheet software. Today, in that same classroom, there's a plaque that refers to VisiCalc as the original killer app of the information age. I'm Scott Kirshner, the Boston Globe's at-large technology columnist. Though VisiCalc was eventually surpassed by software from Lotus Development Corporation and Microsoft, it really helped propel personal computers out of the hands of hobbyists and into the mainstream. Dan has been involved with numerous startups since then, and he maintains a popular weblog. We spoke at his home in Newton about where good ideas come from, the importance of testing new products on virgins, and what made Bill Gates so successful.
If you think back to the VisiCalc days a little bit, was that an instance of having a eureka moment about what was needed, or are you bigger, or was that an instance of kind of incremental, long-term thinking about a problem and sort of slowly coming up with a solution?
It's a combination of eureka moments and ongoing. The breakthroughs for particular problems are often eureka moments, I think. Or maybe to decide to go after a particular thing might be that there is a problem here. I mean, I see that in some of the things I'm doing. But
when you think about VisiCalc, does that seem like it happened quickly? No,
VisiCalc was a deliberate design. I saw a need for an interactive word processing with numbers type of thing, and started daydreaming about that, the idea of a head-up display and being able to say, take these numbers, circle these numbers, and put the sum down here, that type of stuff. But that was in my thinking because I came from WYSIWYG editing, from the newspaper world, and word processing. So I was already thinking in terms of columns on screen, of columns and numbers on screens and words and things placed anywhere you want in a two-dimensional array or two-dimensional space. So then I had to explicitly try to design it. And as I was prototyping it, in the prototyping, you come into a problem. You have to say, well, how do I build this thing? The question was, how do I name the objects? Because I knew there would be these individual cells. But, they weren't cells. They were just like, there's something you're seeing on the screen, which is the sum of some things above it. How do you say this is that plus that? And how do you say this? How do you say that? I mean, how do you say that? And so I thought, I was thinking of things, and I deliberately went through, let's see, we could make a person type in a name. That's what computers usually make you do. Now that's too time-consuming. Well, let's use the order in which they're created, which is another one that computers sometimes use, just, make up numbers for them. That's okay, and you can understand it, but it's not internally grokkable. People really... And then I thought, well, how about putting it on a grid and just use the grid location? Aha, that's an easy one. Let's try that. And that happened to... Out of that then came, well, it made it easier to do certain other things. Inserting in the middle between things worked out better that way.
So that's how cells became A3 or
right.
C15.
Right, and why was it A3 rather than 1, 2 or something? That was because it made it easier for parsing, because I was working with numbers and not with variables, so I knew if it started with a letter, then it was a cell location, because I was into minimum keystrokes to get this thing, and nice and tight for doing it.
My
competition was back of the envelope.
Uh-huh.
I was competing against not using the product, against doing it by hand. So I had to make it as easy and fast and low overhead as possible to you while doing it. So this was
compete with back of the envelope,
back of the envelope or calculator and pencil on paper. So it was a step by step as each problem arose in prototyping it. I had to solve each of those problems.
How important was feedback with VisiCalc, and how important has it been since then when you have a first prototype to show it to people and let them get their hands on it and sort of hear how they think about using it?
It's crucial to get the feedback. I mean, A whole lot of the ease of use of VisiCalc came from showing other people and talking about it. I mean, you know, one of my classmates, John Reese, saw that I had said that, okay, I'm doing 1+, and then I say, instead of saying 3, or instead of saying A5, I could say U, meaning you can use, and then point to another place. He said, well, why do you have to point? Why do you have to use use? You could, when you're pointing 1+, the arrow means nothing, you know? Mm-hmm. So there went the U. But if you say 1+7 arrow, that's unambiguous. That means now move to the next cell to cut down. And that was something that came from showing, you know, talking to him. And
so you used to have to literally hit the key U?
You literally had to hit the key U. If you look at the old design.
To go to the next cell?
No, to point to something. Oh, okay. You wanted to point, you have to say, now I'm about to point.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
And then hit an arrow key.
Then hit the arrow key. But it turned out you don't need to. Now, I missed that. It's obvious. But you had to think that it was unambiguous.
Yeah.
Because of the plus. And John, who's a computer person and MBA student with me, mentioned that one when I was discussing it with him between classes. So there are other things with other products where, you know, people using it, there's nothing like getting people to use it.
I mean, a lot of times entrepreneurs and inventors have this paranoia about, well, gee, I can't really show anyone my product. They might steal my idea. Do you balance it?
You have to. Well, you have to have an inner circle of people you show things to.
Uh-huh.
You always have to keep some virgins who haven't seen it because you want to show it new to people. But feedback helps. It's the hard part was often getting testers. Getting people. I mean, you know, you would get, it'd be forever to get beta testers, and then of those, only 1/10 of them maybe provided, at any one point, provided useful stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a form of beta testing.
A lot of people probably want to tell you, oh, this is great. You know, they just want to be encouraging in some way, right?
That's fine. Well, no, a lot of people just don't get around to using it. They say, sure, I'll try it, and they'll try it once and then not do anything different with it.
Uh-huh.
So you don't get any real feedback.
Yeah.
Not their fault. It isn't until they actually use it. People have to think about it. And then you have to listen to the comments. Sometimes you'll get a comment from one person, but it's specific to their situation, and it's not right. But if you start hearing it from 2 or 3 people, then you really have to think about it. I'm finding it's no different in video editing, that when you show something, you know, or anything like that, you show them the tape, and people say, oh, that's a weird, you know, weird transition. And you say, well, I'm trying to do it for this reason. After the second person tells you it's weird,
you have to stop explaining it.
You better start explaining it and fix it.
Right.
I remember that with products where the same thing. It's like, well, you had to do something, but everybody's pressing enter at this point, but that doesn't fit in the model. Well,
right.
Let it accept enter.
Right. Rather than keep justifying it.
Justifying it, right, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that back of the envelope idea is interesting. So was VisiCalc, when that first was introduced, was it one of these products where people can't quite understand, well, gee, why would I not use the back of the envelope? Why would I not use a calculator? I mean, you hear the stories about when fax machines first came out, people said, well, gee, the U.S. mail is plenty fast. Why would I spend all that money on a fax machine? Do you remember encountering that kind of opposition to, why would I want to use a spreadsheet on my computer?
Well, the big problem is that most people don't see most people aren't programmers, per se, in their heads. Mm-hmm. It's a generic type of thing, of being a programmer. In other words, if you give somebody a generic tool, most people can't imagine how they take the generic tool and apply it to their situation. But if you give them an example that's close enough, and for different people, how close it has to be to their problem varies, and that's what makes it interesting that they're different people. When you get it close enough, they can say, that's exactly what I need for what I want if I tweak it this little bit.
Give me an example of that. You had to find applications of VisiCalc that map to, like, specific jobs?
Yeah. So, for example, I showed it to a Harvard Business School professor who was doing some consulting for us, and Julian Langham ended up working for us. And it wasn't until he thought it was kind of cool, but it wasn't until he actually needed it for a problem where he saw it for a problem that worked for him, a lot of people are like this, that you realize this really makes a big difference. You know, a lot of people, when they saw their problem, but until you show a real estate problem, or until you show a problem around, for press it was, you know, how to do a newsletter, what the costs of a newsletter were.
I mean,
some people, until they actually see their problem. They don't realize how general purpose it is because they're not thinking in terms of programming. With a spreadsheet, that was rampant. All sorts of people only saw it as the problem they were shown in the demo. And it wasn't until they saw an actual example of a thing they needed it for that they got it. And said, you can use it for that. And that's true of so many things. So it was true of the telephone. When the telephone came out, it was, according to some books that I've read, they weren't sure what to use it for. Remember, originally...
Alexander Graham Bell thought it was radio.
It was radio, right.
He thought you'd broadcast concerts and things like that.
You'd sit around the telephone all...
Right.
which we laugh at, but then, you know, now we do have point-to-point, you know, speakerphones and all, maybe. But what they thought it was for business, they started using it like telegraph, and if you used it for a non-business thing, it was considered abuse of the telephone. And to God forbid gossip, you know, well, because gossiping is God forbid. But, to actually use it for just conversing with somebody for fun was considered abuse. But it turned out that people were using it for that, especially people who were isolated on farms.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be using it. And they loved that. And eventually, the telephone company realized that they should get in front of this and reach out and touch somebody. But it comes to people figuring out how to use something. The internet, we had to figure out how to use the internet. The internet's connecting all these computers together. Well, then we figured out how to use it for email. We figured out how to, you know, FTP. We figured out how to use it for web, for HTTP and HTML to do the web. And then we figured out how to use the web for blogs, websites, soap and stuff. I mean, there's just so many, you know, computer-to-computer communications. So we have to figure out these things. That's it's not inherent necessarily in the technology. The spreadsheet was the same thing. People had to figure it out. The tools that are most successful are ones that are very general purpose, can be used for many things and don't get in the way and work really well.
But it sounds like you're saying when you market a tool, even if it's something very general purpose that has lots of applications to lots of different areas, that in marketing it, you really do have to say, here are some concrete examples of how you can use it in real estate, in aviation, in journalism, in whatever.
I think that, that's Jeff Moore's thesis about Inside the Tornado and Crossing the Chasm is that you have to pick your bowling pins. You have to find a specific thing where you can really solve a problem well and do that and market to the people who do that, and they will provide enough money to keep you going until others realize, wait, I can use it for many things.
Mm-hmm.
What I think what happens is there are those people who are able to, who are using, I think this was Forrester's thing of there are people who were very very positive on technology. They look for solutions that use technology, right? And so you need those people in various areas to say, here, I found a technology. I can use it for my thing. Let me figure out how to apply it in my thing. Then once they sort of get it in the ballpark, then somebody else said, ooh, that's close enough. Let me fine-tune how I use it until it's perfect for our area. And then a lot of people say, this is wonderful, and they all follow. Not everybody wants to do that. So there's this balance of explaining to a wide number of people who are those programmers at heart and the technology lovers, and at the same time picking your ones that people can actually use.
I'm curious what you learned, post Harvard Business School in terms of when VisiCalc was out in the market, and then Lotus 1-2-3 came along, and sort of the competitive melee that occurred around the spreadsheets. I mean, what did you learn about competition post-Harvard Business School, and are there some things you might have done differently that you think about where, you know, today people might be using a successor to VisiCalc versus Microsoft Excel?
Well, they are using successor to VisiCalc, depending how you look at it.
A direct descendant
of the code base, for example,
yeah,
as opposed to some philosophy of design. Well, first of all, the structure of the business in those days was author-publisher, separate authors, separate publishers, with a publishing model. We learned, partially because of us and others like it, that that's a not always the optimal model in the software industry, for the PC software industry, because frequently with certain types of software, you build the company around the hit software, and that's your base. And that doesn't fit with an author-publisher relationship that's at odds with each other financially. So we had a problem with that. The other is that there were questions of platform, of where to go, and in hindsight, it's clear certain platforms are the way to follow, like to go on the IBM PC, etc. In our day, we, Microsoft and others, were on a wide platform, writing for the lowest common denominator to make sure that we could port to anybody who came by. Lotus, when they developed Lotus 1-2-3, for various reasons, including its resources and stuff, and to get performance right, ended up targeting the IBM PC at the right time when it was clearly taking off for other reasons. And they nailed it there. We, for various reasons, and the various reasons we didn't add certain features and stuff. So one of the things I learned is, which they teach you in business school, is you stick to the knitting. I mean, you've got to focus. And you have to figure out what business you're in. You have to understand you're in the spreadsheet business. Lotus didn't understand they were in the spreadsheet business with the spreadsheet. You know, they were trying to, they thought that, it seems that they thought that 1-2-3 was sort of an integrated product. Not that it was a spreadsheet, but that it integrated, and that's why it was better. Not that it was a better spreadsheet, which it was, in many ways, than VisiCalc. It had variable column widths and commas and the numbers and, you know, and dollars and all sorts of great things. And it had but it also had graphing, but graphing is always was in the spreadsheet. We just had bar graphs. We didn't have the Apple, the way we had it, couldn't do things as well. We didn't have space. But we wanted to have graphing. And so it was. Then they went into Jazz and to Symphony, and then Jazz trying to do this combined thing, and other companies were doing that. And then they sort of lost some stuff there. And then the graphical user interface, they made some decisions about platforms. Everybody thought that OS2 was the place to go, including Microsoft. And Windows came about. Excel was designed as a real good spreadsheet for the Mac after they had done Multiplan for the Mac. So this figuring out about just focus on what it is you're doing and don't let other things get in the way.
But so you did stay...
It's something we didn't do enough of. We went into multiple products.
Uh-huh.
We had a contractual problem, which is why we couldn't keep on enhancing. And worse yet, even in our where we were enhancing, we were doing it by doing a higher level language you can implement on multiple machines simultaneously, etc., which is the same thing Microsoft was doing for Multiplan. And Lotus went with assembly language tuned to one machine.
Uh-huh.
And, you know...
And sort of focus on, we want to be the best spreadsheet for the IBM PC.
But then they didn't want to be the best spreadsheet for everything, including Windows. And what does it mean to be a spreadsheet? They didn't realize that it's always... The spreadsheet from day one was about output. Was about the results of what you produce. It made it easier to get these results. That was one of the things about, and it was in the design, that you were editing the output is what you were doing in the spreadsheet. And Lotus at 1-2-3 was better than VisiCalc, and it produced much better output, for the printers of the day. But the printers of the day got better, and people wanted better output. One of the better output is, for example, just putting showing the grid in the printout. Because the spreadsheet's used as a database, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's used just to put... It was always designed for just typing things... for what you would do in a paper pencil, where you would write things down that have numbers and words.
Right.
And just a lot of that's record-keeping. Yeah. A lot of them just recording. It's record-keeping. And, so they didn't... The sticking to the name... So that's one of the things I think that... That's the biggest one that I think is where we went wrong.
Trying to be everything to every platform was one of the issues.
Yeah, it is. But that's inherent in the new part of the industry when you don't know which is going to be the winners.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's really tough at the beginning.
That was a function of timing of just when you started the company.
Yeah, some people time it just, well, look, we happened to start when the Apple II was available, and the Apple, we were on the Apple II when it had disk drives, and others didn't have disk drives for another few months, for several months. The timing was very good. 1-2-3 came out at the right time. Had it been, a few years earlier, it would have had problems.
And what did you say about your relationship with the publisher? Was that an issue where your publishing deal said, look, you have to come out with X number of products over this period of time?
Yeah, first of all, there was the relationship between the author and the publisher got strained for various reasons, which we won't get into. And
who was the publisher?
Publisher was Personal Software, later renamed themselves VisiCorp because they liked our products so much.
Uh-huh.
They decided to name their company after it because there was this whole thing of who gets the goodwill and the credit, and that was because that had value, real value. And so we were arguing over value. We should have merged. We were trying to merge, but for various reasons, the merger never occurred. And, though we offered, $10 million at one point. For $10 million, we would have merged, and we were paid $11 million the next year in royalties.
Uh-huh.
So, all of which went to paying programmers and all. I didn't get money out of it. But the multiple platform thing is that you don't know yet what's going to be dominant. You have to be there. Remember the thing, Bill Gates was able to be on any computer. So when IBM came to him, he treated them really well, just like, the guys at Digital Research got so used to so many people coming to them, they had, here's how you have to go through with them, etc., and they treated IBM just like everybody else. And, that didn't work as smoothly as it did. Bill Gates decided, I'm going to make sure IBM is good, but they're very good with a lot of people.
What did you? I mean, you had some interactions with Bill Gates in that early '80s period. What is it you think turned him into such a great competitor and such a force in the industry?
He's always been a great competitor. He doesn't give up. He doesn't really believe in giving up, as far as I know. I mean, he realizes you have to try again, and he has a cash cow. Usually, that's what really won it for him. Is that once he had BASIC as a cash cow. And he could afford to try different other things. And if you have that, it makes up for a myriad of sins, like shipping late. If you still have money coming and you can afford to be late, you can afford to try things. He kept working on CD-ROMs over and over and over again until CD-ROMs actually were a dominant form for many things. He believes in certain areas and kept trying with them. And other companies didn't. As much Lotus would try things and then give up, which Bill once asked me. He said, well, why did they give up on a particular thing? And he said it in a tone that was like, don't they breathe air? It was not a put-down. It was incongruous to him that you don't try your best and keep trying and don't give up, especially when you have the amounts of money that these companies did to do the stick to the knitting at the same time that you're experimenting with other things. I think that's a cultural thing that you have to be careful about, is that, as I remember from outside, what it looked like at Lotus is that people didn't want to be in the spreadsheet business who were there. That was the unglamorous part. And they wanted to be in a new area, and they would only look at areas that were clearly going to grow to billions or 25 million or more in sales, to be huge sellers. So a lot of the experimentation and all just doesn't work. Microsoft did the same at some point. They just assumed they'd buy anything that would become big. The problem they had is a lot of things that they needed didn't occur, so there was nothing to buy.
Yeah. When you think about a problem that you want to address, that could potentially become a new company or new business, how do you approach it? I mean, do you think about problems that are just intellectually interesting to you or technically interesting, or do you think, here's a problem that I think is going to meet some kind of market need? I'm thinking maybe of Trellix, the company you started in the late 90s to make web publishing, web publishing easier. How do you think about it? Do you think about the intellectual?
Right. Well, that was interesting. Now, Trellix, the thought, unfortunately, was a little early because I was writing a help system for a product that I had done at the time, and I realized that linked documents, you know, hypertext documents, of which the web is one of those, were hard to write, and we had no system for keeping track of it and editing it, and that was what we went to do, of which the web was one of the publishing mediums. The other one would be like a PowerPoint presentation, which was a linked type of a document. Unfortunately, I didn't say, well, let's only look at the web and let's do only for web early on. We eventually switched to that and web only as our emphasis, and we became much more successful with that.
But initially, you were thinking about...
It produced a Trellix file, which you could then read with the Trellix reader.
Uh-huh.
But you could also... it's a single file. You could mail it around, do all sorts of stuff. We also figured out a way of taking entire websites and mailing them around and stuff. But we then went to HTML output only, eventually. We always did HTML as one of the formats, but we were very concerned about print format, mm-hmm. about how do you print a linked document, which mm-hmm. something we have still not dealt with mm-hmm. in terms of how do you print a website. Right now, yeah. we just print individual pages and not dealing with something that, for example, the Talmud had to deal with hundreds of years ago, and how do you print a linked document and show all the things. So we were concentrating on that more, and I think that the things we were concentrating on will become more and more obvious that people need it. I actually looked for a particular need and try to figure out a solution for it.
And the need was, how do you produce these, how do you produce help files, help?
Well, how do you produce linked documents, uh-huh. like hypertext documents, per uh-huh. se, which we now think of as websites,
right.
okay, or subparts of a website. The type of things when you really produce a knowledge thing with a lot of links and a lot of things connected together. Mm-hmm. And even that, because it's so hard to write still, most people don't produce those things. It's yeah. so hard to do that with today's tools, even though it was easy with Trellix. So we're still, I think, early, because regular people are not producing those things yet. They're still producing more linear documents as their main thing at work.
So it sounds like...
But that was one thing. But other things I've done are, I realized I needed something, mm-hmm. and others I mention, I'm building some, I do a tool to help me a little bit, and others say, that's neat, I want it. Mm-hmm. And that's where some other tools, like when I did PageGarden, came out of that, because I needed, on a DOS machine, a way of handling laser printers a lot better, mm-hmm. for precise printing, repetitive printing on laser printers.
So a lot of times it's problems that you encounter just in your own use of the computer.
Some of the spreadsheet came out. It wasn't that I was looking for, where's an opportunity, you know, I want to create a company and a product, I want to make a lot of money, what's an opportunity? It's more of, here's a problem, I'm an engineer, I like to solve problems. This is one I think will be of interest.
Do you throw out a lot of stuff if there's not a market need? Or if people say, yeah, it's kind of interesting, but it seems esoteric?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, I think so. It's with it. And if there's no... I will try it on a few people. The problem is as you say, a lot of people, I say, oh, that's interesting. So you have to learn to figure out and calibrate exactly how to listen to people. This is really tough. With the training tapes that I'm working on now, I mean, it's like to figure out exactly which things are the ones that people want. I mean, I ask people, you know, all sorts of people, do you have this? Do you need it? And what would you want in it? Mm-hmm. And certain things are coming back that I don't necessarily want to do, but I'm going to do them because that's what people are asking for. And if enough people ask for it, maybe that's the hot button.
So it's always such alchemy in terms of when you perform market research, what you listen to and what you filter out.
That's where prototyping comes in. I think that you really have to, when you tell somebody what you're going to do, they don't visualize what it is. They visualize what they think they want. And they don't, and the realities of what you can build, which might be a brilliant idea they couldn't comprehend, or, you know, totally useless thing that you could comprehend that they wouldn't even ever want, that until you can actually put something in their hand to try, you don't know. Which is why you've got to build a prototype and let people try it. And then you find out the things you thought were important were unimportant about it, and things that were unimportant are important. And, you know, an investment you thought you'd have to make, you don't have to, and vice versa. So you've got to get to the point of what's that minimum point to get something usable. my friend Frankston and I like to call it scaffold. You build up a scaffold. You have to build a path through the thing that actually works and let really real people use it. And then you have to calibrate the responses to that.
What do you mean calibrate the responses?
Well, if they say that's kind of cool is one thing. It's do they take it and continue to use it and beg you for certain improvements and say, I can't live without it. Those are different, you know, there's some different lines there.
I was going to ask you about that before, which is that one of the problems of every new technology is no matter how great it is, I mean, it sometimes seems like you give it to someone to use and they say they use it once and they never use it again.
Right.
How do you think about, you know, I mean, that's another chasm, right? I mean, there's the Jeffrey Moore chasm that he writes about, but the other chasm is, you know, in every company, there's some new software that's introduced, some knowledge management system that people use once. They technically know how to use it, but they don't frequently use it.
Okay, that's a separate thing. There's the problems they, quote-unquote, should use, but they don't. There's the one that they could use, but they really shouldn't use. And or they're the wrong person, and somebody else would use it all the time. In distinguishing among those are different, and the problem a lot of things are that you should use them but you won't. Like the spreadsheet replaced a lot of tools that you should have used, where you typed in formulas and worked things out on a grid, and they had columns and rows that had headings and footings, and only pros that were required to fill those things out, and they were only for a particular narrow set of uses. The spreadsheet turned out to be usable easy enough that you would use it even, you know, when you should, and you should have used some other tool, it was good enough to use it. And that's a tough chasm to get over in your product design, is something that people will use when they should, even though they wouldn't if it was done differently. You know, what are the barriers to them actually doing it? Those barriers are really tough, and often that's the invention thing. We all know you're supposed to have certain things, but it's figuring out how to make it happen. Like listening to podcasts, you know, doing it at your desk is not for everybody, mm-hmm. but doing it portably is. Well, as soon as we had hard disks or huge memory portable music players, it changed the whole world,
right?
In terms of that.
I guess I want to talk a little bit about, you know, about product design for ease of use, because it strikes me that in the early days of the computer, it really was expected that you would read a manual before using a piece of software, right? You know, you had these 100-page manuals, and people kind of read most of the manual before trying to use the software. Right. And now we're in this era where it's become, I mean, you only consult the manual when you have a problem that you can't get through. I mean, I think about Apple's iMovie software. You could probably pick a lot of other examples where really the way you learn how to use it is by playing around with it.
And they barely give you an example, and some things you really should have a manual for because you run into problems.
But, I mean, is that, in your mind, is that the ultimate product design where you can produce something that doesn't require a manual?
I just had a conversation about this yesterday, which is interesting. First of all, early on, a lot of the things we're doing, we're making things that were almost impossible to do possible. You know, and the fact that you needed a manual to use it was didn't matter because you were saving so much that it was worth it. Okay, and some things like learning to drive a car and all sorts of things in life, learning to dance, take a lot of practice and training. Mm-hmm. You know, few people are naturals at just picking it up, playing piano, etc. But they're worth it once you learn it. Okay, so many things, I think, are that way. You know, video editing, all the things you need to know in it and all that. Some of it, you know, you can just do it, but sometimes it is worth learning the manual. But what we keep hearing from people is make it easier, make it easier, make it easier. And we come from the making impossible things possible, so let's be happy it works at all, to doing things that were used to be hard and making them easy, where now we're expecting that also to be learning easy. We have so many different things to do that we don't have time to learn everything, so we now have a new requirement of that. But people have become so computer literate that we don't have to teach them how to use a menu system. We don't have to teach them what to look for clicking. This is like, you know, a lot of people can use video games. You just sort of sit there and, you know, in 2 seconds in the interface, they can figure out what they can do, and they can try it, and if it doesn't work, it's okay. That type of being able to figure it out took having used enough of them to know the genre. Well, we've learned a lot of the genre that once you've used Amazon, you can use just about any e-commerce site that's of that type. This is something Jacob Nielsen likes to talk about. If everybody does it this way, do it this way. Okay, so that we've lowered the barrier to learning. But what I've seen is there are people who you would think aren't that especially smart, and there are people who you think are really smart. And some of those not especially smart people have no problems using these high-tech tools. Yet some of these people who you think are brilliant, the absent-minded professor, but you think are brilliant, just can't figure out how to use the stuff. It might be that we work so hard to make these things easy to use that, because everybody says, make it easier to use, make it, you know, for dummies and all. We actually made it that all sorts of people can use it without much trouble. But there's a class of thinking that many people have that has nothing to do with your IQ and nothing to do with that some people just don't get. And that there are classes of people that once you know the genre, it's obvious. Once you, you know, if you're a visual thinker, it's obvious. And we're in that world now where we have a lot of people who haven't learned the whole genre. It's becoming car literate involves more than learning to drive. The learning to drive is non-intuitive. The way an accelerator works isn't the way you expect. It's non-linear. The way the braking works, what you have to look out for, what other cars do, the whole thing of change, of getting oil changes, that you're, if you don't do that, it's bad for your car, that you have to get gasoline. How do you get gasoline? What type of gasoline? If you get stuck, what do you do? Well, what's a motel? How do you deal with, I mean, there's just so much to be car literate.
So, but are you saying that...
Same things with computer literate.
I guess I'm asking, in the world of software design, you don't think the paramount goal is to design software that people don't need a manual to use, that is just so clear, transparent, easy to use, that you just turn it on, you start using it for whatever task you want to use it for.
Okay. There are many goals that you have when you design a software product. And we're finding new ones all the time. So one of them is that somebody can use it without a manual. One is that somebody who doesn't know certain things can use it without a manual. Okay. Another one is that it works exactly as you would expect, that it doesn't ever produce bad results, that it doesn't crash, so that there's usability, there's functionality,
reliability.
It does everything you'd ever want it to do. Okay, as opposed to it only does a few things, but it does them real well. You want it to do everything you could. You want it to work in every language. Internationalization. Okay, we keep adding all these requirements. When you do a product, you pick a mixture of those based on the product. So sometimes you say, I want this to do anything that you could do in the medium. Okay, I want to be able to do anything you could do with HTML with this tool. And I wanted to make it easily accessible to somebody who knows HTML. This editing tool lets you get to everything. Okay, talk about something like Dreamweaver. Okay, well, that's not for, you know, for somebody who just wants to put together a blog.
Right, because
who just wants to write.
Sometimes increasing the functionality that's available to you, letting it do everything, makes it much harder to use. Right.
Well,
I mean, you think about turning on Microsoft Word today is a much different experience than it was 10 years ago. I mean, 10 years ago, it was pretty hard not to realize, okay, here's how you write, here's how you delete.
But that was hard. To learn in those days about insert, and that to insert a blank line above something, you click at the beginning and throw a return and go up, or go, you know, I mean, things like that were not obvious, you know. I mean, if you remember, you know, how do you add a line above the first line?
Right.
You know, that was not, I remember my parents do. They couldn't figure it out.
Right.
The first one.
I just was pointing out, though, that as products get more mature and sort of have more functionality built into them, they can sometimes get a little overgrown.
They get overgrown because what happens is, this is Clayton Christensen about in The Innovator's Dilemma, that at some point you reach the functionality that meets what most people need, and you keep going after those people who'll pay more and more for more and more functionality, and there are fewer and fewer of them because you can add the functionality faster than people's needs grow. What happens is that people get comfortable at a certain level, and then they want a little more, and they want a little more, and they grow at a certain level, and that growing is at a different level. So there's this tuning of your functionality, who your marketplace is, ease of use, what the marketplace already knows that you don't have to teach them, where there's a standard you can follow and don't have to invent a standard UI. Using a user a UI that is not optimal for what you're doing, but because the learning is so much easier, it's worth doing it, but it cuts your functionality down. And some, I mean, it's those
a lot of trade-offs.
Yeah, those are trade-offs, and we won't know which works because all these things are in flux. We don't know what works until you hit the marketplace. And this gets to the question of being able to keep at it. Sometimes the thing you want is almost there, a little more work will get it to you, and the market will be there when you're ready 2 years from now if you can only survive.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the, when is it worth pouring more money in? This gets into a question about funding, okay? Because, and this is something that Clayton Christensen points out, that depending on the type of money you get, they have different time frames and different decision of using the money. And sometimes the assumption is that I've got all my ducks in a row. I got everything ready. All I have to do is get the marketing up to this level and do this and make this feature work, and you pour the money in to make it be there. When it turns out there's some other things that haven't gotten there yet, and you wasted that money. That what you really needed to do is to be self-sufficient of some sort or have a small amount of money and keep working until the conditions come right and then pour the money in.
I was gonna ask you a question about money because I'm interested to know. I mean, there are lots of entrepreneurs who have an idea, have a product. Maybe it's even something that they've built and prototyped. And the question is, gee, how do you raise the money to get it out there into the world? You know, do you hit up your friends and relatives and your dentist for money? Do you go for traditional venture capital? Do you get a bank loan? I mean, how do you think about the right source of funding to kind of make your idea a reality?
It's real tough because different products need different type at different times, and a product that, let's say, can only produce a certain revenue, if you think in a perfect world, which you didn't realize, but it turns out it only has a certain potential. If you spend more than that potential, if you're wasting your money. But if you could have spent less, then you make money, and this level that you spend at, that's appropriate. There's also a minimum level you can spend to make that is necessary for the thing to take off. You know, these things are all nonlinear. And you have to find that magic point. And many things, I think if you can work with a minimum amount of money, has its advantages to get it to that level. Because you have less questions about control and about what the other people want to do. And most new ventures are funded by friends and family and stuff like that. That's their numbers about that. It just isn't that the VCs just don't have the capability of funding that many. Plus, they have to fund it at a minimum level, and that level may be inappropriate for weeding out certain things that can't grow to the amount that they need. Though they still may be valuable things to do in their own right. What we're seeing is with new technology, the cost to get in the game, that low level necessary to start, has dropped.
Mm-hmm.
So TV production has dropped. Music production some time ago dropped, that you don't need massive amounts of money to be able to produce a really good recording.
Or you don't need access to $1 million studio.
That when that happened, that was a huge thing, because you could do everything, including, and with the internet you can do distribution, but it always could be you could do distribution at your concert among friends. That ability to produce at a low cost, with so many things, software development has always been that way. Luckily, we could develop, but it's got even more so thanks to the lowercase open source world.
Mm-hmm.
Has opened up many things. It's always been the case that there was software you could get that came bundled in with something you were getting, either free or for a small amount of money, that would provide functionality, libraries of various sorts. We're now getting so much more available that way that you can start from such a bigger base without having to build it all yourself. So that the cost to get up to a certain level is much lower. This is really good.
That is good, but then people always get to the point where they have something that works. Maybe it's even really a capital P product, right?
Right.
and it's, I need money to hire salespeople. I need money to buy advertising, kind of the sales and marketing issue.
Well, there's this belief that there is a certain way of marketing, a certain way of running your business, that there is only a few business models. And what we've seen over forever is that there are always new business models. There used to be a business model that you had to have your own capital to do things. You would not borrow because borrowing was wrong. It was against the Bible. And people did not borrow, right? And at least not where there's interest involved and stuff. And then at some point they figured that borrowing and interest was actually in the interest of the person who was borrowing, because it wasn't, you're not taking advantage of them, they're taking advantage of the bank, because they're going to take the banks. That was a whole new okay. The same thing about software, of there being prepackaged software, was an innovation, where one size would fit many people rather than custom for the thing. We're now, with many things, how you market, what your channels are, what the costs are, music, we're seeing this now, the duplication fees, and distribution fees and shelf space are not what they used to be. And there are other things about how you discover artists and stuff like that that may be, and we have to change the mixture. In product development, it's the same thing, that maybe marketing, the costs of marketing have changed. The way of being able to do viral things of your customers telling others may have changed, where certain ways of doing things can cost different amounts, so that you can, we have to experiment with that. The many things don't have to go with the traditional way. There still are things that have to go with the traditional way, and there still are things where you have to say, I'm willing to take a risk. I have this idea, I've proven it enough. Is somebody willing to take the risk of their own money, be it me or somebody else, to say, I will invest what's necessary to get this to the next level that will become self-sustaining? And we just have to realize that there isn't one size fits all here. We need many different ways of doing funding. And we have to have many different ways of doing the marketing and of finding out. It shouldn't be that everybody has to take out ads in the Wall Street Journal, multiple page ads. When you understand that, you know, we have a type of narrow casting we didn't have before. Now, we've seen that happen in the last few years. AdWords, paid placement in search, paid search advertising, has opened up an enormous thing where the cost of marketing has dropped to much smaller than it used to for certain things. You know, many of these are small businesses, but some are small, big businesses. They're finding out that they can now, they don't have to waste their advertising budget on people it wasn't necessary for. You don't have to run a Super Bowl ad for many things. You could get by with just a targeted ad that costs you $5 every time it runs. But only 1,000 people are going to buy your things, and you know, and your thing is worthwhile, and you can get those 1,000 people, and you won't get anybody who's not the 1,000 people. Mm-hmm. Those are really that type of stuff. You have to, when that happens, that's great. But some of them just don't exist, and why waste your money? If the targeted, if the inexpensive way of marketing to the right people doesn't exist, then maybe your product isn't ready. That's part of your product being ready. Just because a product does what it's supposed to doesn't mean that it's economical to be able to sell it. It's not its time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, timing can be very important. You can be too early in technology.
You can be way too early with things. I mean, think of all the things.
Yeah, that seems to me the most frustrating thing to an entrepreneur is when you've done something that's a breakthrough, but it's a breakthrough 5 years before its time.
Yeah, but the hard part, I mean, this was the thing, people, going back to VisiCalc, people looked at VisiCalc and said, oh, VisiCalc's horrible. It had no help system, had a very minimal help system, but it had a help system. It was very minimal. Why? Well, the spec had a help system, but we got rid of it because there was no memory for it. We said, we could give you the help, or we could give you a data sheet. Which do you want? Well, people wanted the data sheet, because that's the whole idea, is to save what your numbers, to save three numbers and have a good help system was useless. the decision of what not to put in so that you're at the time is one of the hardest things of being a software developer, to actually ship a product that is usable on today's hardware or whatever it is. To make those trade-offs is the hard part.
But we're talking about two different things. One is making the trade-offs to get out this year versus 2 years from now, right? One is the trade-off saying, okay, what can today's technology do?
Right.
And the other thing is saying, okay, you might ship it this year. You might ship a great product this year, but the market doesn't realize it, won't realize that it needs that product
right.
for another 3 years. And so there's no one out there to buy it.
So the question is, do you not finish your development and wait, or do you produce a lower level product, or do you produce that product and it is going to require the seeding from that? And you have to choose the right type of marketing that will pay for itself, that you're not wasting your money to be able to get a real community and get that seed going so that when it happens. There's the other thing, which is rampant in the technology business now, which is really good. I mean, this is a good rampant thing, is you produce a product knowing that you may not make it. It happens in the drug world and stuff too, the pharmaceuticals, that you're producing a product waiting for a bigger company to say, this is the technology that I want.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the right product. I have the channel. I have the stuff. And you're now ready. So the person built the thing and then held on to stay alive.
Right. The survival is survival. Key. Being able to survive is key.
I see this all the time, that a product in an area where there are two or three products that struggle and struggle and struggle until the thing hits, and then they get the ones that are still alive get picked up by the big companies right away, and they become, you know, one of them maybe hits it big on its own, and the rest
right.
get picked up by the competitors.
But you wouldn't want to have that as your starting strategy, right?
You may not want to, but if it, since it is a potential, the cash out scenario is an
yeah.
important one. There are many things about that. One, of course, is, well, now in open source, that's why people care about the open source licenses and what licenses do you have and what rights do you have. They really care about that
yeah.
stuff because the cash-out scenario is going to be important. You know, you don't build certain infrastructure knowing that you're going to partner with somebody else. And you build your company knowing that you're going to use some other company to do those things.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that it may take a long time to find those partners, why waste trying to build it yourself? That it won't be worth it to build that. Like building a sales force, it's not worth building certain national sales forces. It may be better to get the product right until somebody with the national sales force determines it's ready to do it. But build your company such that you can stay around until that happens on a cash flow positive basis. That's why the CEO has to get the big bucks for figuring out how to navigate through those things. It's really tough to navigate through this. It's on a case-by-case basis. There's no one way to do it, and that's why many fail.
Let me just ask you a CEO question. So as a founder, do you feel like it's important to just psychologically realize, I might be starting this company, I might be developing the technology, but at some point I'm going to have to give up the reins and bring in a CEO that has lots of experience selling to the pharmaceutical industry or has some skill set
yeah.
that you might not have?
I think if you believe in your product and what you want to do is to get your product successful and the company successful, you want to do whatever is right for the company. And the product. And different products need different things. Sometimes you need somebody who completely understands the product and completely understands the user really well, which is often the entrepreneur who founded the company, to guide the company. There have been many entrepreneurs who have successfully led their company for many, many years there. Ken Olson did that for many years when what they were producing was the right thing. Bill Gates is always, there are people who did. But there are some times where that is not the important thing, that you need to know how to sell, how to do that, and the entrepreneur doesn't have that. Then, of course, it's worth bringing, or you have to build up a company and the infrastructure of a company, and the entrepreneur doesn't have those skills.
But you think as a founder, it's important to be open to the possibility that, hey, I might not be a Bill Gates type where I can lead my company from $1 of revenue to, you know, $1 billion.
It is important if your goal is to maximize the success of the company from a financial viewpoint, from a sales viewpoint, the product from a similar type of viewpoint or a acceptance viewpoint. If your goal is to have a company that provides enough money for you to live in a nice manner, and you like being in, and your goal is to be in charge of a company, which is a laudable goal, if you want to be a small business person because you love being in charge, then work your company that way and don't delude yourself into thinking you want to do things that you're not able to do. And the things that you're not able to do, build your company around only doing it to the level that you're capable and want to do it. I mean, and many people do that, and they live very happy lives. And as a believer in small business, I think that's a laudable goal. It's a laudable goal to say that my business won't be as big as it could be, that it will be big enough to meet my goals. And one of my goals is to be in charge.